Welcome to the Benefits Executive Roundtable, hosted by Dorothy Koshu, President of Advanced Benefit Consulting. Dorothy is a nationally recognized benefits and compliance consultant and group health broker. Here, you'll listen to industry experts break down the latest news and trends in employee benefits, healthcare reform, regulations and compliance, all designed to empower executive decisions.
Welcome to the Benefits Executive Roundtable. I'm your host, Dorothy Koshu, President of Advanced Benefit Consulting, and I'd like to welcome back my guests today, Marilyn Monahan of Monahan Law Office, Ted Flitner, and Ted Miyashiba of Aditi Group, our IT, cybersecurity, and technology partners, for part two of this special podcast event during Cybersecurity Awareness Month. Welcome, and thanks for coming back to talk more about the Department of Labor EBSA cybersecurity guidance.
I'm really happy to be back with you here today, Dorothy, as well as Ted and Ted.
Great to be back. We've got more to talk about.
Happy to return, Dorothy.
Thank you very much. Let's talk about the process of selecting service providers with strong cybersecurity programs in place. And we talked about this earlier, but I want to come back to it because it's very important. What is the best way to compare service providers? And what are some of the things that employer plan sponsors and fiduciaries should be doing?
Well, checking references is always a good idea. Make certain that they are reliable references and references that you can rely upon.
You know, really asking for a third-party expertise to maybe do some investigation. Similar to when you may do a background check on someone, you can hire a third-party, you know, company to maybe do some background check on your service provider to see, you know, are there complaints? Are there things that maybe have not made it to the surface that are, you know, records that are available, but they're not easily obtained? You know, so you can have someone else look into that. You can also get a IT security company like ours to look at it and evaluate and say, do we think the practices that they are using internally, that they say they're using, that they're reporting, do we think that they are appropriate for your needs? Do we think that they will maintain those and perform the way that you want in this long-term relationship?
Yeah, and as we talked about before, some sort of questionnaire, some sort of chart for comparing them, that will actually help you quite a bit as well, as we talked about before. You've got to have a way to document and compare service providers. If you don't have that documentation, as we talked about before, you know, you're going to have some issues potentially in the event of an audit or being able to prove why you made the selections that you did. And continuing that line of thought, I know Marilyn and I have talked about this in various webinars before and discussions and so forth. Avoid working with friends, families, and golf buddies. Marilyn, do you want to talk a little bit more about that? Why are there potential issues there?
Yeah, so that's another potential issue under ERISA, because working with what they call a party in interest could raise prohibited transaction problems. That's a whole other topic of conversation that we don't need to get into here today, other than to emphasize is you're looking for the best service provider possible. Choosing a service provider is a fiduciary function, and you want to approach the process from that perspective and keeping that legal obligation in mind at all times. You want to choose a service provider that's going to best serve the needs of your participants and beneficiaries.
Thank you for that. Let's talk about monitoring the service providers again. I know that we talked about it, but let's look at it again from the IT perspective. How do you do that? And what are some of the best practices?
Well, if you've taken a journalism class, you learned about 5 W's and 1 H. Who, what, when, where, why, and how. So similarly, from the IT perspective, those are the things that you need to cover. Things like what fields do you determine in your negotiation with your service provider, what data fields do you consider to be of interest, of PII? Those are the things that you have to be able to identify and be able to say, how do you protect these particular fields? But if you're talking to an IT person from the service provider, they'll want to know that. And you want to be able to get an assurance from them, they're going to protect that. And how are you going to protect that? And do you check the log books to see that people who do not have rights to that information don't get in? The who is who has the rights. So understanding who has the data rights to update, to make changes just to fields and systems are critical. When do you authorize people to access your system and their system? Is it a 24/7? Are there times when you have a blackout period where people are not allowed? Because otherwise, you're asking the provider to monitor their system at all times for you. And if they have full up staff for 24/7, great. But if it's up to you in your evaluation to make sure that that's what's happening. Where do you allow people to authorize your system, both internally and to the cloud provider? Because there are places in this world, North Korea comes to mind, that you don't want people accessing the system, right? Do they have ways to block those kinds of access? IP addresses from Ukraine, probably problematic at this point. From Nigeria, from Russia, from China, can you identify where you can access the system and where you cannot? How do you classify your people? Do you have groups? It certainly makes things easier for the IT provider if you say this group of people and you give them which IDs they have can do these functions and be able to separate them, keeping administrative rights separate from everybody else. Is a function that's a best practice in cybersecurity. And finally, ensure everybody understands why they're doing this. Why is cybersecurity a big deal? And if your providers and if your own people understand that, then you've opened up processes for communication. If they see things that are unusual, you know, it's the old see something, say something. That process has to be in place both within your own organization and with the service provider. As I think Marilyn said before, if your people are complaining and they think that your service provider is not taking cybersecurity seriously, there has to be a process in place that you know about it and you can take steps to do something about it.
The Department of Labor says employer plan sponsors need a complete cybersecurity program in place. Ted and Ted, what does this mean and how does an employer plan sponsor accomplish this?
Well, this is about this being a formal thing. You know, it's not something you visit occasionally. It's not something you did once. It's not part of the negotiation process and that's it, or part of the selection process for a plan provider. It is about saying this is a formal, ongoing, everyday, 365 way of doing business, way of managing our company, and way of managing our relationships with these other providers. So it says that this now has to be formal. And I think Ted can speak to CISA again.
Right. I think it's probably appropriate for you, the employer, to ask your service provider, are they familiar with the CISA, CISA recommendations? If they don't, do you have an alternative? Is there some other kind of program? And there are a few out there. But if they don't, it raises a red flag to me that they have not considered this systemically, that this is not that they don't take cybersecurity sufficiently seriously to be a good partner for you.
The Department of Labor guidance states that plan sponsors have to have best practices in place that should include things like conducting prudent annual risk assessments, reliable annual third-party audit of security controls, and strong access control procedures. Can you walk us through some of the best practices of this in the world of IT, Ted and Ted?
If we go back to the CISA guidelines, reducing the likelihood of damaging cyber intrusion includes validating all remote access points. Check all your access control procedures. Ensure internal systems are secure, which is basically risk assessment, right? This is something, our broad brush risk assessment broadly covers best practices for your cybersecurity program. And ensure that this risk assessment then goes to your cloud services provider, for instance, or whoever your service provider is, most of them are in the cloud, and ask them to give you the results of their risk assessment. take steps to quickly detect a potential intrusion? What systems do you have in place to detect intrusion? And there are many. Some deal with logs. What systems do you have in place to detect exfiltration of data? How do you know people are running away with your data? This is a question both for your provider and also for yourself. Ensure that organizations prepared to respond if an intrusion occurs. This is a crisis response team. This is where you put a team together, both internally and with your provider. These include somebody from IT, somebody from legal, somebody from management, somebody from the outside, somebody who specializes in outside communications. In other words, from your company's perspective, what are we going to say and when are we going to say it? And has it been cleared by legal and approved by management? That's why the team is put together. And finally, business continuity. How do we make sure we can continue even if, and this is a scenario that we often ask our clients, even if that cloud provider system goes dark, what do you do? Have you thought about that? Where are you going to get the information? How can you deal with even old information? Maximize the organization's resilience to a destructive cyber incident. Test your backups. Test your restore procedure. Can you manually continue all your work if certain aspects of your IT system go down? Those are really the best practices to make sure that you're prepared from a cybersecurity standpoint.
Yeah, and some of the details of the, like the access control, we're going to be looking at multi-factor authentication. Is that required on every administrative account? Are they using separate administrator accounts versus general user accounts? Are there, you know, basically, are we dividing things and separating the eggs into separate baskets from the IT administration perspective, keeping the risks minimized? And when, you know, we're talking about the business continuity, the resilience perspective, you know, think about all the examples that we have seen over the last couple of years where we've had the ransomware attacks, and especially municipalities when they have been, you know, just shut down, whether it's a city, whether it's a county, or what have you. There have been, you know, some major shutdowns because the data was either held hostage or just, you know, they weren't able to access it or deleted. And think about all the functions, you know, for example, in Suffolk County, New York, you know, where they had a huge cybersecurity breach. And, you know, many, many months later, some of the basic functions of government were still really not happening, or they were greatly delayed with backlogs because now they're trying to, you know, come up with paper records and archives. You know, so think about those things that we've seen. We want to avoid those, and we want to have backup for everything. We want to have a plan. And, you know, this doesn't just apply to your, you know, your plan provider. This is, you know, how do you run your own business? You know, how do you make sure that you stay in business if your IT systems go down, whether it's a power outage, whether you have a flood, an earthquake, so on, some kind of catastrophic damage, or hopefully not, in the unlikely event, we say, in the event that you have a ransomware attack or a breach.
Yeah, it's not like those things haven't happened as of late. I mean, those things are like an everyday occurrence, it seems like, which is pretty scary, but the reality of our world today. Well, how important is ongoing cybersecurity awareness training, speaking on all those things you just talked about? I mean, I would think that would be pretty important.
It is key, because, you know, we always go back to what we say in our training sessions with HIPAA, is that the weak link is the person. You know, the human is the weak link. People, throughout all the big breaches that have happened, all the big major breaches, these are, for the most part, you know, 99% of these breaches are not Mission Impossible, you know, groups sitting in a room doing very sophisticated hacks. They may lead to more sophisticated hacks and tools and so on, but they almost always start with the very basic. Somebody clicked on something that they shouldn't. And that's a human thing. That's a, you know, that's a human response. And so we need continual training there at all levels of the organization. And in this case, the DOL said, okay, you need to do that for managing your company. You need to do that for managing your provider. They need to be doing that. And you should also be training your employees to not be doing silly things, unsafe things. They should be following good practices. So it really applies everywhere, because if it's not in the conversation on a regular basis, especially as employees, we know it's not important. Our kids know that. When the parents aren't talking about it much, the kids know it's not important. You know, so it has to be continually in the conversation, and we have to be reminded, and we have to be updated on what are the newest, latest gambits that are being used.
So let's talk about some real world solutions and some how-to suggestions. Where do we start?
We always start with the risk assessment. We always want to start with, you know, where do we have a problem? and usually we don't know everywhere that we have a problem, because that's not, you know, we're not looking for the problems all day, every day. Guys like Ted and myself, we're looking for those problems on behalf of other people. But when you're running your business, you know, that's not what you're looking at every day. So you really need to start with the risk assessment, and whether that's a checklist, a task list, whether that's, you know, following various different risk assessment tools that are out there, doing a risk assessment, or having a third party like a company like ours come in and perform that for you and look for you, or whether it's that survey that your cyber insurance company gave you. You start there with saying, where do I have a problem?
Well, let's come back to something that you just mentioned. Let's start with creating a task list. Let's walk our listeners through some internal practices and some service provider practices. You guys want to comment on this?
For instance, let's take good access control procedures. Well, you may have a policy and you may have a procedure, but there's nothing that is better than just walking through an office and looking for post-it notes that are on screens, or pulling open a drawer and seeing what the little yellow sticky notes that have on there. For instance, all the passwords, right? I mean, that's not good access control. I mean, there are password managers on there, which is something we would suggest everybody avail themselves of. Using good passphrases and long, complicated passwords. You know, that's part of the risk assessment. Part of the risk assessment is going in and seeing what's actually happening. There are moments when there's nothing that beats walking up to a public window on the outside of a business and looking in and being able to see exactly what's on the screen of somebody who's inputting private data. That's a risk. But is that access control? Is that something that we can put into a list? Easy to miss, right? There's a lot of access control procedures that can be just visibly seen and put onto your risk analysis. So being able to do a good risk analysis involves actually being able to walk through the office. And as I think, Dorothy, you used to do is put, you know, those paper dollar bills or $100 bills. Here's a violation. You can't leave this out on the desk. You can have all the procedures you want, but there's a lot to be said for being able to walk through and say, this is what I see. This is what you're not doing. And therefore, it's a risk. Making sure that your team is ready to act is really probably the biggest thing that we can say when we do risk analysis, because we're actually saying to you, so you have these plans. Have you tested them? Right? Going back to Colonial Pipeline in the Southeast, where they had a hacking, and they said, that's not a problem. Not a problem. Let the hackers have that data. We'll just shut everything down. We'll put new equipment in place, and then we'll restore from backup everything. We might lose a few hours, and that'll be fine. Well, what they found out when they tried to restore the data was they couldn't. The data was corrupt. The system to restore the data didn't work. And so after trying this for a week, they finally said, okay, Uncle, we'll pay the ransom. Well, you know, the time to find that out is not after you've been attacked. It's before, right? try the backups, make sure they work, try the restores, make sure they work, and test that on some kind of a regular basis, you know, even semi-annually, annually. Make sure that that things have not changed so much that we can't restore everything from a backup, because that's our plan. Well, make sure that it really works.
Yeah, it seems pretty simple when you mention it, but it's, you know, the reality is it just doesn't seem to be happening. People aren't testing. People don't know that there's a problem. People constantly, they don't know any of these issues exist until they receive that ransomware, you know, note, or that, you know, that
right.
That scary, well, that scary picture comes up on the screen or whatever.
Well, you know, we do what we're paid to do, you know, and if it's something that, you know, we don't see a direct requirement for it, then generally we're not going to do this, you know, certainly in business. And so that's what is so important with all this, what we're talking about today, is we're putting these requirements on our, on ourselves, you know, our company, and on our service providers. Hey, this is part of what you need to do for me to pay you money to provide a service for me. Now, you need to be, you know, checking these backups and showing me. And then we go back to, you know, the idea of doing audits. Okay, show me that you've audited it. Show me that you have successfully been able to do a backup. Or, you know, I want to see that that happens on a regular basis. Because this is part of the value that I'm paying you for, is to maintain service today and maintain service in the future when things may go sideways.
And that little thing, like training your employees, is such a huge part of all this. And yet that seems to be the thing, that the one step that a lot of employers just aren't doing at all, or not enough of. They're not keeping current with the current threats and that sort of things. And I know that you guys talk about that a lot in our HIPAA training.
Training is fine if you, you know, but the problem is, for most people, it's just one way, right? You sit there and you talk at them and they play with their phone and they leave the room and that's it, right? What you have to be able to do is close that loop. I train you to do these things or not do these things. And there has to be some kind of vulnerability test, or and there are a lot of softwares out there that do this. For instance, where you train people, well, don't click on this, and then you send them an email with that particular vulnerability on it. It's from a white hat. In other words, somebody you've contracted to send these fake emails on there. And when they click on it, it goes back to your cybersecurity manager and they say, this person just did what we just told them not to do. They may need some additional training. So you have to close the loop. You can't just say we're going to do it and say we've checked the box and we're done.
And that's the step that's missing most often from what I see. Marilyn, we talked about this earlier, but I want to come back to it because it is so important. Service provider contracts. What do employer plan sponsors need to do related to their contracts? Let's just summarize this again. I know we talked about it earlier, but because this is important, I'd like you to hit on this again, if you wouldn't mind.
I'm happy to. The first item I would refer people to is the service provider tip sheet that the Department of Labor produced in response to the GAO recommendations. So start there. They do give some high-level recommendations regarding things that you should look for in your service provider contract related to limitations on liability and cybersecurity insurance and the like. But let's bring that home and summarize some of the additional tips that I might add to that process. One is, don't forget that a service provider agreement doesn't necessarily replace your obligation to have a HIPAA business associate agreement in place, even if your service provider agreement addresses cybersecurity. The HIPAA rules are different and they're separate, so you still have to have that business associate agreement in place. Some other things that you want to look for in the service provider agreement are, does it adequately protect your interests? I see a lot of contracts that don't adequately outline, for example, who is going to perform what service, under what conditions, under what timelines, and so forth. You want to understand who is responsible for what. Also, with regard to protecting your interests, look at the indemnification provisions and look at any limitation of liability provisions. If there's a problem, even if it's non-cybersecurity related, are you adequately indemnified in the event of a lawsuit? Are you adequately protected in the event of a breach? Think about information security reporting. If a problem arises, will the service provider promptly let you know about it and then work with you to fix it, to mitigate it, to get out breach notification notices if that's called for under the law, either federal or state, and so forth. Have provisions that specify any limitations that are appropriate on their use and sharing of the data. Understand whether or not they're going to be subcontracting any of the work that they perform. And if they are, what protections are in place if they are subcontracting some of that work so that your data is kept secure. And those are some of the main provisions that I would focus on. I would just say again, as I said earlier in the podcast, don't simply sign the agreement that the service provider hands you. Read it over, understand it, get legal review where necessary. Make certain it does address any concerns you've had. Consider issues that have arisen in the past with other service providers performing the same or similar services, or just other service providers who have worked for your company. What kinds of issues have arisen and what kinds of provisions do you want to make certain are wrapped into this agreement so that you can act accordingly if a problem or a concern arises?
Thank you very much for that. One of the things we talked about in our webinar in June was assigning oversight and timelines to complete. What are some suggestions here?
Once an assessment is done, a risk assessment, there are invariably action items that come from that. Each of those action items should have a timeline, a due date. We have to keep this actionable because time marches on. Bad guys aren't sitting around waiting for you to fix these things. So it's time for you to get going, fix these things, and then in some time period, review that and make sure that it's in place and is working as you expected.
This is part of a formal cybersecurity program, you know, that was mentioned earlier, and that's part of the best practices that the DOL is calling for. If it's not in writing, it didn't happen. If it didn't happen and it's not in writing, it's not a program. It's not formal. You know, so creating that formal program looks at the what, the who, the when, where, and so we're really making sure that we have identified responsible people. We have identified when actions are due, when communication is due. In some cases, it's, for example, as Ted mentioned, it's action items or items that came out of the risk assessment. There's also, you know, what is the procedure for feedback? What is the procedure for reporting to your service provider that you have a problem? What's the procedure for them reporting back to you? And how long do they have to report back to you? You know, how long do they have to go and investigate it before they come back with an answer? You know, it's about defining roles and responsibilities and the requirements of responsiveness within them.
Yeah, and one of the things, Marilyn, that you mentioned in our webinar was how important it is to have things like a meeting agenda, minutes from that meeting, showing that you've had discussions on, you know, what you determined was best practices and why this did or didn't work or something like that. Would you like to comment on that?
Some of this documentation is really can be very, very functional. You know, having a meeting agenda is a way to have an effective meeting. It's also documentation that you can include as part of your permanent records.
I would agree with what both Dorothy and Ted said. And it's all about having a paper trail so that you can explain and recollect why it is that you made the decision you did. And so that if anyone ever says to you, why did you choose XYZ? Then you can say, these are the reasons that we looked at, we examined, we considered, and this is how we came to the decision that we thought was in the best interests of our participants at the time, based on the data that was available to us.
Thank you for that. Let's talk about creating an overall cybersecurity program. What does that mean? Because we have a lot of questions on this. What do you mean you have to create a program? What does that exactly mean? Can you guys share some thoughts on that?
Well, a cybersecurity program, it's not a one-size-fits-all. Every company is different. That's why we emphasize risk assessment. The beginning of any cybersecurity program, if you don't have one, begins with risk assessment. Where are the problems? Work on local control first, making sure that everything that in your area is locked down and you have access controls and you have mitigated all the risks there. Then work with your vendor or cloud provider on cloud control. Then after that, the third step is to work with your vendor on what-if scenarios. We're a part of your cloud IT and or local IT are unavailable. What is plan B? So in a nutshell, that's the overview of what a cybersecurity program really is.
Related to that, Ted, didn't we talk about in a previous presentation that a lot of these incidents occur over the weekend? So you really need a plan B so that you know who you can reach out to when these crises occur, because they often don't happen at a convenient time on Wednesday at noon. They happen Friday at 5 o'clock as everyone's walking out the door.
By design, you know, and in fact, that's by design. That's, you know, like when the LAUSD big hack happened. When did that happen? Labor Day weekend, right? The perfect time.
Right.
You know, when the response resources are maybe not at maximum, you know, so having that response plan, you know, is, again, it's part of the formality. And as, you know, Ted mentioned, you start with, you know, what are my risks? You know, let's lock down my risk and so on. And so really a formal plan, it starts, start simple and you can get more and more complex. But it's about having this formal and having it be ongoing, not just one time, one and done, you're out, because your workforce is dynamic. The risks are dynamic. Your infrastructure changes. You know, whatever computers you're using today are not going to be the same in every way in the future. Software is always being updated. You know, so this is all. The cybersecurity risks is an ongoing thing, and it's ever evolving thing, you know. So this doesn't have to be super sophisticated. Doesn't have to be a huge organization of people involved in terms of managing the cybersecurity program, but it has to be formal and it has to be ongoing.
Right. One of the things that we hit on all the time in our privacy and security training is that creation of written policies and procedures, as you mentioned, Ted. If it's not written, it didn't happen, so says the government. What are some examples of the types of policies and procedures that employer plan sponsors need to have related to the DOL cybersecurity guidance?
I think that policies and procedures really need to outline for everyone what you can, and more importantly, what people think of with policies procedures is an outline of what they can't do, but really, and more importantly, is an outline of what you can do. So, you know, people are very creative on how they interpret rules. Policies and procedures are rules. And so the policies procedures really outline the company's position on many items. One of the things we see from the IT perspective that kind of drives us nuts is we look at a bunch of computers and they have all these multiplayer games. And multiplayer games are a headache. It opens up a lot of ports. And the people who are out there doing malware understand that if this game is on the computer, they have a way in to that computer, unbeknownst to the user. But while they're playing the game, that port's open. Well, if you have no procedures saying you're not allowed to load that onto your laptop, especially since we're in a world of work from home or work from anywhere, and people are lax about what they allow or don't allow on a particular work computer, that has to be thought through, because there are things that if you allow them to add those potential risk factors to a work computer that is doing work and holds work data, you are opening yourself up to a lot of liability.
Yeah, I want to just kind of summarize some of the things that we talk about in our privacy and security training, some of the examples of policies and procedures that we always throw out there for employers to consider creating: physical and administrative policies, electronic policies, as you guys talked about many times, the what, who, why, when, where, and how are you going to identify and protect all this data. We suggest electronic written policies and procedures for everything. We talk about remote and hybrid workplaces, as you mentioned, Ted. You've got to have policies in writing that define all of these things. What are you going to do with those people when they're working from home or partially from home? And devices, your devices other than your computers. I mean, everybody pretty much knows they're supposed to protect their computers, but do they know that they're supposed to protect their phones, their tablets, the thumb drives, things like that? And of course, training people within your policies and procedures and elsewhere about what we've talked about many times today and many times in the past, that weakest link, your employees. So that's just summarizing some of the policies and procedures that we talk about on a regular basis in our trainings for the HIPAA world. Is there anything you'd like to add to that?
And within there, there's details, you know, like there's no sharing of passwords. You're not allowed to share your login with anybody else. Ideally, we want the access control mechanisms that are in place to use multi-factor authentication that helps ensure that you're not sharing your password with somebody else or your login with somebody else. But people can still game the system and say, okay, you know, I'll text you the code when you go log in with my account, you know. But those, some of these things have to be in writing, especially when it comes time for enforcement or some kind of retroaction. We have to have these things in writing, in policies and procedures, in advance in order to have any kind of disciplinary process. And without disciplinary processes, you know, again, we don't have teeth in it. It's kind of like saying, well, you know, I say it's important, but I'm never going to, you know, have any discipline, you know, for this. It's like telling your kids that don't do that, and I'm never actually going to make anything happen, or you know, I'm never going to put any discipline in place if you do it. You know, that they don't really mean it, you know, so there has to be some teeth in it. And in order to put teeth in it, you got to put it in writing in advance.
With regard to discipline, I think it is important to talk about during training, as well as putting it in the policies, as well as putting it in the employee handbook, that failure to follow company established policies and procedures with regard to PII or PHI or whatever protected information it may be, could result in discipline of varying degrees, up to and including termination in particular circumstances. Some employers even have their employees sign off on some acknowledgement of that. And then I want to also follow up on some comments Dorothy and Ted Miyashiba were making earlier about reminding people about where you want to protect the data, not only remotely and the phones and the laptops and so forth, but business travel is picking up again. So think about how you're handling laptop access if you're staying in hotels, if you're traveling through airports, and those kinds of things. So I think the company should have some policies on that and should train employees on what best practices are and things not to do, as well as things that they can do.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. So how often should companies do a risk assessment?
At least every year. You know, things change, people change, the risks change. Often the infrastructure changes, computers change, and software changes. You know, so it really should be something you do at least every year. In some cases, more often. And really the driver of more often is, did you make a major system change, infrastructure change, or, you know, team change? Did something significantly change? Or did your, you know, like your third-party companies that you deal with, your service providers, did they change? So that's a big driver.
Well, thank you. This isn't just about plan sponsors and plan fiduciaries, as we talked about in the beginning. Plan participants also play a role here, and, you know, they have to be accountable for their own account security. In fact, one of the guidance, as Marilyn mentioned in the beginning, was actually designed to help plan participants protect their own data and their own passwords. How important, on a scale of 1 to 10, is plan participant training and education on the importance of cybersecurity? What do you guys think? 1 to 10.
Yeah. I'll vote for 10.
Yeah. People are the weakest link, whether they are the user or your employee. And so, you know, that's got to be a big part of it, is that they need to learn to protect themselves and their own data.
Yeah, I'd rate that as a 12 or a 20 or something, because it, really any technical safeguards and procedures that can be put in place can be defeated on the inside. And of course, the hacker's trying to defeat them from the outside. And, you know, ultimately, it's kind of an arms race. The hackers figure some way out or find a weakness that, you know, seems to be in a system. So they, you know, usually will keep trying to, you know, make their way in. But it's even easier for people to defeat those on the inside.
Yeah. And I have to tell you, I really like this particular guidance from the DOL. As a matter of fact, I just had open enrollment meetings recently for one of our clients, and part of their open enrollment meeting was planned participant training on cybersecurity and all sorts of HIPAA and related privacy rules training. And part of that was I actually handed out the DOL guidance, and I'm doing that now every time we do trainings and every time we do open enrollment meetings, because I think it's really important, and I think somebody needs to discuss with the plan participants what this is all about. So let's talk about this a little bit. Marilyn, can you kind of summarize what this guidance includes for plan participants?
So yes, so the Department of Labor online security tip for plan participants talks about having regularly monitoring your account to make certain that you know if there is unusual or inappropriate activity, that you're aware of what's going on. Use strong and unique passwords. Don't use password 1234. There's endless stories about how that gets people into trouble. Use multi-factor authentication where it is made available to you. Keep your personal contact information current so that if you do get a letter, because they sometimes follow up with letters letting you know that, you know, a big major deduction has been taken from your retirement account, make sure that actually reaches you. Close or delete unused accounts. Be wary of free Wi-Fi. Be aware of phishing attacks. Use antivirus software and know how to report identity theft and cybersecurity incidents. And I'll also note, Dorothy talked about including cybersecurity tips as part of open enrollment process, but, you know, employers should also feel free to send out periodic security reminders throughout the year, either by email or text or in another format, you know, or a reminder about passwords or some other step that you might want to remind plan participants or employees to take. Employees might very well appreciate that education, and it might prompt them to, for example, update that password, that weak password that they've had for a while. If they forgot about it after they were reminded during the open enrollment meeting, maybe a month later, tell them about it.
Ted, we talk about this a lot in our trainings for privacy and security. What do you guys recommend as far as, you know, the small little bits of training that you guys talk about throughout the year?
Keep it short. Keep it short. You know, keep it, keep repeating. One of the things that Marilyn mentioned there that's on the, basically the online security tips, just this two pager, is beware of phishing attacks. You know, in phishing attacks, there's a lot of different ways that they play out. And they become more sophisticated, you know, as we go on, and AI is probably helping to create more sophisticated ones. So continue to get in people's faces about reminding them and, you know, keeping them updated on some of the gambits that are happening. And one of the things that we often see is, you know, in the larger companies, as one or two people, you know, may, you know, first see this message, and, you know, if they're savvy, they'll contact their leadership or their IT team and say, hey, is this legit? And we'll say, no, it's not. And then we'll follow that up with a message to everybody, you know, to all employees saying, hey, that you might run into this, you know, look for it. You know, so training like that, being aware of phishing attacks and being smart about avoiding them, that's the kind of thing where you want to have just short bits of frequent training. You know, here's some examples. And as Ted Mashiba said, you also want to follow it up with some testing so that the people really get it before it really, really matters.
National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, which is October this year, emphasizes four things: enabling multi-factor authentication, using strong passwords and a password manager, updating your software, keeping your software up to date, your operating system up to date. And finally, recognizing and reporting phishing, as Mr. Flintner just talked about. The part of this that often gets missed is the reporting phishing. Every company has to have a process by which if a phishing attack or attempt comes through, that gets reported somewhere. And the FBI has a place to report these things, but the company should have that as well for two reasons. One, to make sure that the employees understand that the company is serious. We take this seriously. And two, just to get a account of what kinds of phishing attacks they're getting so that they can generalize and let everybody know. This seems to be the vector that everybody chooses for our company. Each company is going to be a little different. So reporting it gets kills two birds with one stone. One is makes people aware that they will report it. And two, enforces that the company really cares.
And thanks so much for everyone for participating in this very important two-part podcast. I know that many listeners out there are probably thinking this is really overwhelming. So let's let them know how we can help them if they need it. As I mentioned earlier, ABC offers a complete cybersecurity program guide to our clients and others, and we can offer our service provider cybersecurity questionnaire to assist you in complying with the tips for hiring a service provider. In that guidance, we include a chart for service provider comparisons and rating comparisons to show, you know, that you've done your due diligence in the event of an audit. If you want to go to our show notes, then you can fill out a form and then I can send you the questionnaire to help get you started. So that's something we can do to help you. You can also watch our June 20th webinar on our Empowered Education Center on our website. So that's some of the things that we can do for you. Marilyn, what services can you provide to assist with the cybersecurity legal issues that we discussed today?
Well, I can help employers and plan fiduciaries draft contracts as well as review and edit contracts. I can also provide guidance and training on fiduciary responsibilities, record retention responsibilities, and cybersecurity practices.
And Ted, how can you help?
Well, we can start at the beginning, and that's really with the risk assessments and, you know, as an independent third party, you know, auditing. We can also follow that with if you've got security problems, security risks, we can follow that with recommendations. That's on the IT consulting perspective. And we can help you with the implementation of the solutions if you need help. That's extra horsepower and technical to get the job done. And then we can follow that with cybersecurity and compliance training. We can help you with cyber insurance preparation, get you so that you will pass the ever stringent qualifications to get cybersecurity insurance. And we can also help you with the day-to-day. That's managed IT services. So if you have a network in your office or you don't have a network in your office, if you've got distributed workforce or a central location, we can support you by keeping everything running day-to-day. We basically take care of your IT so you can take care of your business. And the last thing that we also do is we do computer equipment leasing so that you don't have to swallow a huge big ticket if you're looking at a big infrastructure change.
Well, thank you for that. And now that we've said how we can help you, if any of our listeners should want to contact you, how can they do that? Marilyn?
Well, you can contact me at marilyn@monahanlawoffice.com.
Thank you. And what about Aditi?
You can reach out to us at info@aditigroup.com. That's aditigroup.com. You can also reach us at 855-462-3484.
Well, thanks again to all of you and to everybody else out there. Please stay safe, stay healthy, and stay tuned for the next episode of the Benefits Executive Roundtable. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for compliance tips, cost containment ideas, new trends, and decision-making tools. This podcast is produced by Advanced Benefit Consulting, Anaheim, California. All views expressed are those of the host or interviewees and not necessarily those of Advanced Benefit Consulting. Information contained herein should not be construed as legal advice. We always recommend that you consult with your legal counsel as situations do vary. Ms. Koshu can be reached at 714-693-9754 extension 3, toll free at 866-658-3835, or visit our website at advancedbenefitconsulting.com.